Welcome to A Spiro Life for October 1st, 2011. The intention with A Spiro Life is to share with you the latest and most up-to-date insights of the changes taking place on our planet. We invite your feedback and comments as to what could assist you as we move towards this collective awakening. As a Master of Nutritional Scientists, welcome to A Spiro Life for October 1st, 2011. The intention with A Spiro Life is to share with you the latest and most up-to-date insights of the changes taking place on our planet. We invite your feedback and comments as to what could assist you as we move towards this collective awakening. As a Master of Nutritional Sciences, numerologist, astrologer, and coach, I'd like to invite you to join me for my teleseminar October 23rd to 28th on Getting Green, a 10 to 20 minute daily inspirational course you can view at your convenience, focusing on wellness, detox, superfoods, going green daily recipes for you and your family, solutions for the busy lifestyle we're all leading, abundance, and building your spiritual wisdom. We're going to be talking about energetic changes, hormones, beauty, and brain power. We all have a lot to contend with these days, and this teleseminar is intended to share with you what I've learned over my 25 years of study and research. There's no way we can deal with the energetic shifts unless our physical bodies are tuned to their highest potential, and this one-week teleseminar will show you how to increase your vitality, clarity, and youthfulness to awaken to your beautiful you. To register, send an email to Cyrilla, C-Y-R-I-L-L-A, at Aspiro, A-S-P-I-R-O, lifestyle.ca. Please put Getting Green in the subject line and what elements of this program most interest you. Details of the event will follow once I receive your email. Participation fee for this week is $26. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Jude Kuravan. Jude has journeyed to nearly 70 countries around the world as a planetary healer, author, inspirational speaker, and business leader. With numerous degrees and career accolades to her name, in 1997, Jude decided to leave the corporate world and blend her knowledge of international business with her passion and interest in the exploration of consciousness and metaphysics. Her insight, authenticity, and wisdom is what you will hear today, and you can get in touch with Jude at www.judekuravan.com. Welcome, Jude, to A Spiro Life. We're happy to have you.
Oh, Cyril, it's wonderful to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. I mean, I have a few of your books, and, you know, you've been on my mind a few times when I've done interviews, and I thought after your message that I read in the September newsletter, and the funny thing is that as I'm doing these interviews now, I find that prior, the last few years, I have a month or two where I have these insights about, you know, who should I go to next, and who can relay the message that I really feel strongly about. And the lead time for this is getting shorter and shorter. I mean, it usually happens about a week now before I actually have to have this due. So I just wanted to thank you for being so flexible and accommodating with the short notice. The first thing I wanted to talk about, and as I said to you a little earlier, I read in your newsletter was about your fascinating experience that you had in Japan at the time of the tsunami and what you experienced there. So maybe you can start and we can begin talking about that, because that's going to take us down a whole bunch of different roads. So can you tell us a little bit about what you experienced at that time?
Well, I've been working actually in Japan for many years. In my previous incarnation as an international businesswoman, I actually set up businesses in Japan, and so began to understand a little bit about the Japanese people and their history some years ago. But over the last 3 years, I've been visiting Japan regularly, and all my books now are in Japanese. But what I've been working with is energetically the landscape of Japan and the ancestors of the Japanese people and the relationship that they used to have, a very harmonious, a very balanced relationship between people and landscape. And that goes back at least 14,000 to 16,000 years. You know, the Jomon ancestors of the Japanese were the first people we know of to develop pottery, and it's way, way before anybody else did it. And for literally something of the order of 12,000 years or more, they lived in incredible harmony, and they weren't just hunter-gatherers. They lived in villages, and they harvested the land, but they did so in a beautiful, balanced way. And so my work over the last 3 years have really been working with the Jomon ancestors and the Lemurian ancestors before that, and also this incredible relationship that the modern Japan over the last 150 years progressively has really pushed to the side. And my sense of how the Japanese people have really needed to rediscover their own history and heal, really, the dysfunctionality that I've found and that many people have commented on in the culture. And, of course, I was there a few days before the March 11th earthquake and tsunami, and I was actually giving a seminar to about 150 people in Tokyo, and I was saying all of this, and I was saying that essentially I felt that they were energetically very stuck and that they needed to become unstuck, both within themselves and also with their relationship with the earth, with Gaia. And the title of that seminar was the title of my very first book in English that is the only one of my books that hadn't been as yet translated into Japanese. And of all things, it was called The Wave.
Oh.
So here I am giving a seminar on the theme of the wave of change, the tidal wave of change, and the needing to become unstuck literally only less than a week before the earthquake and the tsunami, which actually did a lot more damage than the earthquake itself.
So, I mean, one of the things that struck me, and maybe this is where we can go from here, is just the grace and the peacefulness of the Japanese people in terms of how they handled that whole experience. So when you're talking about their connection with Lemuria, I know culturally, I've had the experience, I do Ikebana, which for those of you who don't know, it's flower arranging. And there's such sacredness in the Japanese flower arranging of Ikebana, and that's one element of, you know, how to work with nature, and it's very symbolic in terms of what they do. But that grace and peacefulness and just the way they handled everything, I mean, it must have been incredible to be there and be witnessing that.
It was, and it still is. It's inspirational, Cirilla. Just a small example. I was on the 10th floor of a Tokyo apartment block when the earthquake hit. And it was just myself and my wonderful Japanese representative, Hideki Miura. And we just sat there because there was nothing else we could do. But both of us went very calm and just attuned with Gaia and just had that sense of these waves on waves of shaking and back and forth came forward. And Hideki really embodied that grace during those minutes that could have been they were frightening, but they could have been absolutely terrifying. And afterwards, we went down onto the streets of Tokyo, and people were calm, they were coming together, they were supporting each other. And you'll laugh at this, but we went through the streets back to the apartment that I stay at there, and even with everything that was happening, traffic, first of all, was still stopping when there was a red light.
Oh, my God.
Everybody was still following the principles of society. But also, we stopped outside this tiny little grocery store. And everybody, of course, was in the street, including the shop assistants. And, yeah, I'm British, so I have to have tea. Tea got us through World Wars, so I have to have a cup of tea. And I know that back at the apartment, I don't have any tea bags.
Right. Right.
So I say to Hideki, do you think we could buy some tea bags here? And he looks at me as I'm absolutely crazy. But he translates to this assistant who's in the street, and the assistant, without even pausing, just bowed and in Japanese said, of course, and went into a shop, which was actually quite a brave thing to do because there could have very easily been aftershocks. Nobody knew what was, you know, potentially coming. But bless him, he went in, we got my tea bags, and we went out. But that's such a tiny thing, but it sort of expresses how the Japanese people did react to something. They with stoicism and with grace. And in the days afterwards, people really, and still do, are supporting each other so much. And what is really interesting for me is that the day afterwards, the Prime Minister went on TV and said, you know, this is a day of grief, a day of deep, deep national grief. And the sheer numbers of people that were lost were still rising into tens of thousands. But he said, you know, we're going to come together and we're going to remember this time as the time for rebirth of Japan. And I've been back since, and I'm going back again in November and possibly in October too. And people are doing that. They're actually people that have been sort of disengaged from society because of the way it was, and especially young people are volunteering to help. They're going up north, where the damage was by far the greatest, to help. And so it really is inspirational. It really is. And I think it's an inspiration for the rest of the world. I think what these events are doing, how we respond to them, is actually, you know, coming home to us. You know, what are our choices? Do we retreat into fear when something really, really challenging happens? Or do we take a leap into love? And the Japanese decided to take a leap into love.
And what a great example for the rest of the planet.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we've seen in other parts of the world when there's been any kind of disaster at times, where there can be this mass hysteria and looting and destruction,
yeah,
and everything else. And it's just such a symbol for what this new vibration and experience can be for us on this planet.
Absolutely. And you talk about the looting, and it was another fascinating aspect of the Japanese response. Was that, you know, for people who had lost virtually everything, their homes, their livelihoods, often, you know, family and friends, with the tsunami, there was this huge, you know, push out to sea, but also there was then, you know, the incoming wave, and things got washed up on shore. And there were a lot of things from the houses that had been destroyed, of household safe, and bags. And, you know, wallets and purses and things like that. And there wasn't a single story of anyone taking any of them. Instead, what people were doing was finding these things in the debris, on the shoreline or whatever, and handing them into the authorities. And something like 98% of them, tens of millions of pounds worth, found their way to the family of people, or the people themselves, or the family of people who'd been lost. Nobody kept it for themselves. No looting whatsoever.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Now, explain to me a little bit about your connection, or what you see the connection is, rather, with Japan and Lemuria. Because, you know, the whole Atlantis and Lemuria, there's controversy, let's say, or indecision about where each of them were located. And I know, for example, the Hunas in Hawaii, they are said to have been tied to Lemuria. So, and I mean, they're in the same longitude, roughly. So can you explain to me a little bit about how you made that connection?
Well, this is a very personal thing, but many, many years ago, well, first of all, I've been walking between worlds, as it were, all my life. I had my first if you like, multidimensional experience when I was 4 years old. So I've been clairaudient and clairvoyant and clairkinesthetic all my life. Mm-hmm. And about 13 or 14 years ago, it might be even more now, I had a spontaneous past life memory of being in Lemuria. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very powerful. And I write a little bit about it in one of my books called The 13th Step, because the memory of that life and the guidance, the spiritual guidance that came up at the time that I was experiencing this, really led me on a global odyssey. And it was an odyssey because it took something like 6 years to complete it. And it was very much going to sacred sites around the world and helping to energetically activate the planetary grid for this time of shift that we're all going through. And as I went through that, I remembered, again, just remembered more and more about that life in Lemuria. And my memory and my perspective is it was something of the order of 39,000 years ago, so a vast time frame. But when I started to go to Japan, Hideki and myself were very careful to honor the ancestors, the Jomon ancestors, mm-hmm. And really call them. And because I do this work in the way I do, I was able to communicate with them and felt guided by them. And over the last 3 years or more that I've been working in this way with Japan and gone to many sacred sites around Japan, I've also had phenomenal initiatory experiences that have just deepened my awareness of the long, long history of the Japanese ancestry, going back to that era, and my own understanding too. And I have worked with the kahunas in Hawaii and with the Native American elders in America, both North and South America. And there is a view that's held in Japan itself that many, many, many thousands of years ago, it was indeed the Japanese people who actually undertook the ocean voyages to, again, become the sort of the forerunners of these people, because there's an incredible oceanic tide that goes from the southern coast of Japan all the way across the Pacific to Hawaii and onto the west coast of North America, and then down that west coast of America to Southern America, and then back again. So it's not out of reason that actually happened, and certainly a lot of Japanese people believe it did. And I really would love to see sometimes some real genetic work done that sort of shows whether this in fact may be the case. But in any event, that's the work I was doing. So in my own perspective, the Japanese people have undertaken, if you like, a karmic contract, almost on behalf of the whole of humanity, to remember this ancient aspect of our collective psyche. And I think that's also tied in with their involvement with the nuclear energy.
Well, and that was going to be my next comment when you said about they carry a lot of karma, because when you look at what happened to Japan during World War II, and then you see this devastation and all around nuclear power, you know, the fascinating thing that I read in your newsletter is about, you know, what China's doing now with thorium, and I found that extremely hopeful, because you know, this whole, and again, because of my connection with France and the amount of nuclear power they use over there, you know, it's just one of those things that I see. Nuclear power, oil, these are the things that we kind of energetically want to move away from. So what do you think, what do you think is the tie between the nuclear power or the uranium and Japan?
Well, uranium is natural. Uranium is the heaviest natural element. And yet what happened was in 1940, uranium was artificially bombarded essentially with neutrons to create plutonium. Mm-hmm. And it's plutonium that really is the energizer of atomic bombs.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened in 1940 was the beginning, if you like, of the nuclear age. And it's very interesting because when you look at the astrology of the exact moment of the discovery or the creation, because it was the creation, the artificial creation of plutonium, it's absolutely fascinating. And we do know that moment because the scientists who created plutonium did so at 8 p.m. on the 14th of December 1940 at the University of California at Berkeley. So when you know that moment and that place, that time and that place, you can draw up the birth chart essentially for the element.
Right.
And when you do that, it really is extraordinary because what it shows is that the planet Pluto, which itself had only been discovered a few years before,
mm-hmm.
is very, very central to the energetic birth chart of the element plutonium. And without going into detail of the chart, because we want to cover a lot of other things, it really shows that creation was potentially transformational for our human journey, and of course transformational in the sense of a positive transformational breakthrough or potentially catastrophic as a breakdown. Of course, what happened is that following that discovery, plutonium and the whole of nuclear fission became the basis for the technology that went on to create the atomic bombs.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, the only people who've ever suffered being bombed in this way are the Japanese people. Now, interestingly enough, nuclear fission, which is a natural process, As elements get heavier, they're naturally radioactive. Bits drop off.
Right.
But they do so in a very harmless way. And in fact, as a physicist, and science physicists will tell you, and I'm a physicist as well, is that this, what's called a weak nuclear force, which is the basis of nuclear fission, but also other processes within nature, the weak nuclear force is the main force that guides and underlines evolution. We wouldn't be having this conversation. We wouldn't be living on planet Earth without the weak nuclear force having played its part since the very beginning of the universe. And so until 1945, with the first sort of test of the atom bomb and then dropping it on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the weak nuclear force and therefore nuclear fission had always been a generator of life, of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Our choice was to make it a weapon of death. And that's a choice that we have continued to make really ever since, because after the war, when it was decided that nuclear energy should be used for ostensibly peaceful purposes, there were other ways of creating and working with nuclear energy that would have been much less dangerous, much more benevolent than working with uranium and therefore plutonium. And one of those is thorium. But that road wasn't traveled because the waste products, as it were, of the nuclear process were not weapons-grade material. In other words, if the nuclear industry had gone to use thorium, which is also naturally available, much more so than uranium in the world, essentially, oh, bear with me, while the phone's going,
okay.
But essentially it wouldn't have been able to produce weapons, whereas the uranium that's used in nuclear power plants can do that.
I see. Interesting. And so the Japanese took on that karma, we'll call it.
Yes.
For what purpose, in your opinion, or what, you know, when you, because you've spent so much time there energetically, you know, I'm sure you can feel what a lot of this is about.
Yeah, I do. What I feel is that when I began to remember, if you like, my own Lemurian heritage, I began to work much more closely, energetically, with the elemental and devic realms of Gaia.
Mm-hmm.
And some while after I started to do this, a friend of mine who's a healer works with various techniques to see if someone has certain preponderance of minerals or vitamins or a lack of in their system.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, go on, test it on me. And what he found is that I was radioactive. He actually found that my energy field was radioactive.
Mm-hmm.
But not, you know, at a very, very low level, but more so than human beings are. And what I feel is that, and I'd love geomancers, people who work with earth energies, to have these sort of tests, because what I found was that the more you do work energetically with Gaia, the energy field of Gaia, and with the elementals and devic realms, they are naturally radioactive. And I'm sure the Lemurians understood this and experienced this, because they, of all our, if you like, our ancestral peoples, worked at that level with Gaia and the consciousness of Gaia. And so this Lemurian connection through the Japanese people, I think, is this ancient understanding of the benevolence of natural, harmless radioactivity, but knowing that a point would come in our technological development when we would, as humanity, discover the power of the atom. And so at that point, we have that choice as to whether to work with the atomic power in a benevolent way or not. And I think what the Japanese karmic contract has been, with that Lemurian heritage and that understanding, is to be the people who suffered the agony of being bombed in this way. Then after that, because they are so resource poor in Japan, continue that karmic contract to go with what they perceive as the only nuclear technology available, which was the uranium route, to come to a point with the tsunami and with the meltdown of the Fukushima plant. Now, what Fukushima did is, I think, it provided this enormous wake-up call around the world to recognize that we cannot go on working with nuclear power as a road of death, that we have to find a different way. You know, we know nuclear energy, we've understood atomic power, but how can we work with it benevolently? And there are ways to do that. The other thing that's interesting is that the mayor of Hiroshima, who is himself an inspirational character, is at the forefront, along with a group of something like 500 city mayors around the world in many, many countries, at the very forefront of nuclear non-proliferation. So I think that's another way in which this karmic contract is playing out in Japan.
Well, the topic I want to touch on with that is when you're talking about radiation, because I have a master's in natural medicine, so I've done a lot of investigating, and this year in particular, one of the talks in my field is increased radiation in our environment.
Mm.
So are you intuitively feeling that your increased radiation levels that you were measured in your body, that they're not detrimental to your health?
I know that they're not. The levels that I was measured, and this goes back something like 11 years or so,
mm-hmm.
Were at a low level, and certainly know that the work that my friend did, he then tested whether they were detrimental,
mm-hmm.
and found that categorically they're not. And there is a lot of work in Europe, or there was quite a lot of work in Europe over the last century, on actual using disused mines, which have naturally a low level of radioactivity, for health purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that is different from where there is an artificially created higher level
right.
of radioactivity.
Well, when I listened to this research or investigated it this year, I wondered, because what they say is that the United States government has actually changed where the level of radiation in the body can be. They change
right.
those levels because everybody is measuring, or the Earth is measuring, more radiation. And so when I read some of the information about that, I thought, is this something to alert us to, these power plants, and how it's one more sign that we need to find alternative sources of energy. So I just wanted to bring that up because it's something that, you know, since Fukushima has happened, certainly in some of the health information about radioactivity and radiation, you know, in our environment and in our bodies, that's increasing. So I thank you for bringing that up and talking about your experience with that.
But also, you know, I would wholeheartedly say we need to move away from uranium-based nuclear power.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from all of that, there is also that, you know, the whole process, if you like, proliferates nuclear weaponry.
Right.
The wonderful thing about the alternatives, which, you know, in my view, and a lot of environmental activists share this, including James Lovelock, who was the originator of the Gaia Hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
James is a supporter of benevolent and safe nuclear energy, because he perceives, and many others do, there's a very well-known activist over here in the UK called George Monbiot, and all of them believe that, you know, we will need a transitional technology, and that sustainables such as solar and tidal and wind are not going to answer our needs over the next, you know, 20 to 30 years, although we obviously have to keep doing as many renewables as we possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
But their view is we will need some form of nuclear energy. And one option, which the Chinese Academy of Science has announced they were going to go down, and this was 2 weeks, they announced it just a couple of weeks before Fukushima, is the thorium route. And India are probably going to go down this route as well. And Japan, I think, more and more are moving their focus to going down this so-called thorium route.
Mm-hmm. And this is a much safer route from what I have read in your newsletter.
It is, because, first of all, thorium is a naturally radioactive material. It's much more available than uranium, but symbolically, its half-life is almost the same as the age of the universe, which is beautifully symbolic. But the point is, it is safe. Its waste products cannot be made into bombs. And the design of the nuclear power plant means that it can never have a meltdown in the same way that Fukushima did. But even better, in my view, is the fact that to kick-start a thorium reaction, you can actually use plutonium weapons, and the process eats them.
Let's get rid of those.
Isn't that fabulous? I mean, you know, let's get rid of the things. Right, feed them into a thorium reactor and let it eat them.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody at this point, or there's been a lot of questions as to what to do with all this nuclear byproduct that we have. They, you know, it's like, well, it goes in the ground and it stays there for how many ever thousands of years?
That's
a fantastic alternative.
Yeah, I know. So there are a lot of people now who are really beginning to push this. You know, it was already, the technology was already developed 50 years ago.
Ah.
But There was a man called Weinberg in the States who was a wonderful man, and he developed this. And basically, it was completely not just ignored, but, you know, he lost his job. I mean, you know, it was out of it. And the reason was that it wasn't able to supply weapons-grade material for the bombs. Of course, it was the Cold War. So, I mean, mutually assured destruction, madness. And so more and more bombs were being made. And the best way, the easiest way of making the material for the bombs was the nuclear power plants.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating, some of the choices humanity's made. But you can see with this coming out or looking at China, you know, I mean, these are huge markets, China, India, and Japan, just in sheer numbers, that if those countries decide to make this shift, it's going to create this gigantic wave over the Earth. So the universe's timing is impeccable.
Okay. Isn't it wonderful? Wonderful. And the Japanese, you know, the contract of the Japanese, I really do feel, is to show that to us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Show this to us.
And they have certainly done it in a very graceful way.
Yeah.
Moving from Japan to other parts of the globe, I just, you know, we're going to talk about your book, Hope, before we finish, because I think that this whole conversation and what we need to focus on is hope.
Yes.
But given that there's so much going on in the EU and with the euro and with the North American markets, for that matter, and mm-hmm. in the U.S., and your extensive business background, I'd like you to give us your perspective on what you think is going on.
Well, I think it's a necessarily transformation of organizations and institutions and systems that have become hugely dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of economies serving the people, it's completely gone about face, and now people are slaves to an economic model that has, you know, is way past its sell-by date.
That's an understatement.
Yeah, it certainly is, isn't it? I mean, when we had the first crisis in 2007 and 2008, I'd known a year before that. I'd been told by my spiritual guides a year before that it was coming, and to anybody with eyes to see, it was, because the whole bubble was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it was going to burst.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look back on previous boom and bust cycles, inevitably they did, and it always begins with some trader or some banker or someone wanting to make a lot of money.
Right.
In different ways. And that was true from the South Sea bubble of the 18th century through to the dot-com bubble through to the the subprime bubble. But I think the danger of the last period of time is, with computerization and global markets, is everything now is so inextricably linked that what would have been dampened out in the past just, you know, grew like this huge monster, and therefore when the crash came, it was dramatically worse because of that. And the problem has been, and this is where I think we can really do something about this, is that over the last dozen or so years, the level of speculative trading has just exploded.
Mm-hmm.
And it's speculation on anything. It started off quite sensibly when you know, I was in business many, many years ago with insurance policies and what-if scenarios and appropriate methods by which businesses could mitigate risk. But that literally grew into a monster of speculation and casino banking on any possibility that could be thought of. Now, you know, if we think of the economy, and I guess most of us think of the economy as buying and selling of products and services, the real economy, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Think of that maybe as a single product, maybe a car worth $10,000, yeah?
Right, right.
This speculative economy, if you like, or the speculative trading, ostensibly insurance. Think of it as insurance, taking out insurance for a car, okay? So if you had a $10,000 car, how much do you think you'd be prepared to pay for the insurance?
Are you asking me?
Yeah. Would you pay up to $1,000 a year?
Probably.
Okay, so you've got a $10,000 car. You're willing for everything to be covered to pay $1,000 a year on insurance, yeah?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, think of the economy, the world economy, as the car. You'd think, therefore, that the speculative trading would be, what, 10% of that economy?
That's right.
Yeah?
Yes.
It's not. It's 20 times bigger than the economy.
Right.
So it's like instead of $1,000 insurance for a $10,000 car, it's like every year you're paying $200,000 to cover a $10,000 car.
Right.
So what you've got is you've got the trading, the casino banking, the speculative economy completely swamping anything that's real and useful in terms of trade. But the problem is, it's the basic money that you and me and small businesses and millions of people bank in our retail banking that actually forms a collateral for all of this casino banking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just got bigger and bigger and bigger and more crazy and more greedy, because the bankers and the traders and vast amounts of money for basically risking other people's money. So, you know, what we can do, and it's not rocket science, but it needs political will, and that's the problem, is we can literally add a stroke, say, enough. We are separating all of this speculative trading with other people's money from the basic retail banking that supports the real economy. And we could do that at a stroke of a pen if there was the political will to do it.
So when we see the markets, and what I've noticed is, you know, I mean, when I would speak to my grandparents, for example, or parents who were in their 70s, you know, at one point in my parents' lives, and certainly in my grandparents' lives, if they bought a stock, they kept it for decades.
Exactly.
And then we moved into this time in 1999 as things started to speed up where, you know, you might hold it for a year or two and then you would sell it. And now this year, in the last few years especially, you know, people are trading weekly, daily. I mean, they're not holding on to anything. So the stock market as it stands, is this what you see collapsing while the if you what we want to call it, retail marketplace, it still kind of chugs along through this recovery? Is that what you're seeing?
I think it's even worse than that. What's happening is the speculation. There is speculation on stocks, and you're absolutely right. The speed of transfers has gone up dramatically, so fast, in fact, that a lot of stocks are not even traded by people. There are computer programs that basically the algorithm says if a stock moves by such and such, you sell it or you buy it or whatever. And that can cause major spikes, completely nothing to do with how a stock is really trading, but just because there's either an error or you know, something's overloaded within the computer system. That's an issue that needs resolving and could be resolved. But what I'm talking about is the actual complete swamping, the drowning of anything to do with real companies, real people, the real economy,
mm-hmm.
in this speculative free-for-all that, for example, is speculating now on basic foodstuffs, is speculating on energy and oil, which means that prices are spiking and prices are going up,
mm-hmm.
not because of the basic equation between supply and demand, but in many instances, and more so, because of just speculation by traders. And that's what we need to stop.
And so how do you see humanity transitioning through this?
In a way, I wish I could say that we could manage our way through this. And I believe we still can. But I believe to do that, both politicians and us, every one of us, needs to act differently. So, for example, politicians need to come together. This is a global problem. It's no good, you know, making rules in one country, you know, that are more rigorous and regulations stronger, only to have, you know, the speculators run somewhere else where it's easier. So if politicians can come together to actually create and impose better regulation, separation of speculative trading and banking from the basic retail banking, and, you know, much stronger regulation, then I think we have a very, very good chance. I also think that at an even deeper level, we have to move beyond the very measures of the economy that we've used for so long. You know, even the people who invented gross domestic product as an economic measure realized that it was completely inadequate to gauge the well-being, the health of a society. They knew that if it was just treated as the be-all and end-all, that it would cause, you know, major problems. And yet that's what we do. We talk about growth as if only growth is good, and only growth, by which we mean growth in GDP, mm-hmm. gross domestic product, is good. Mm-hmm. But GDP growth driven from consumerism and conflict, neither of which are healthy or well. So we do have some even more fundamental changes to make. If we can make them, and I believe they're not complex, actually, mm-hmm. It's not rocket science, but we do need political and social will to do it, then we can work through this.
Well, as you know, and many people who are listening to this show, with what is going on with the outer planets, you know, Pluto and Capricorn.
Oh, yeah.
Uranus and Aries, and the square between Saturn and Pluto. All of these, our structures are coming down.
Yeah.
You know, the medical, educational, banking systems, etc. And everybody at the top that was kind of benefiting the most, they're all being exposed, and that's changing.
It is indeed.
There's many people that are saying, you know, that we'll move away completely from any kind of monetary system, or the new dimension that we're moving into, that monetary system will not be necessary. It's not part of that energy or frequency. Because I'm left and right brained, I can't help myself. You know, I try and envision that, but I feel that there's more of a middle ground solution.
Yes.
So, you know, what are your thoughts about that? Because I'm sure I'm not the only one that's heard that about, you know, the monetary system is going to disappear completely. There will, from my perspective, there's going to be some need for measure with trading, etc. How do you see that?
I see it very similarly to you, I think, and I'm left and right brain as well. For me, and I also, all my life, have, as you have, I'm sure, Cyrilla, worked energetically, and for me, money is energy. It's an expression of energy. You know, the Bible, God bless it, says, you know, money, it's not money is the root of all evil, it's the love of money.
Right.
And I think what the love of money often reflects someone's inner loss and inner security, inner lack of security. So as we go through this shift, as we, I feel, become more empowered, more balanced, more healed, then it's not the love of money somehow to feed our perception of insecurity. But hopefully we will move to a much more balanced and healthy treatment and work with money. I call it health, in other words, healthy wealth, which is based on far more than monetary aspects. But I do feel that money as energy to flow to lubricate trading, but a real trade, a real expression of mutuality. I think, you know, there is a place for that. And I do, like you, I find it very difficult to envisage a world where that isn't the case, but I can more easily see a world where it's a much healthier relationship with money.
And I think that's what we're in the throes of now, which leads me to wanting to talk about your latest book, Hope, Healing Our People and Earth, because I think that through these changes, although outwardly many people can get into the fear of what's happening, fundamentally, I, you know, have this sense of hope that this change is in some ways long overdue, and that there's this excitement, especially, you know, maybe this is just my perspective, but since July and August, when almost energetically we were feeling a build-up that there was change coming, you know, September and moving into October and November, it's just, it seems to be this crescendo that there's events are moving faster, change is happening rapid fire, but as unsettling as it can be for some people, I find it exciting because for so long we've been waiting for this shift of energy. So I want to go from that to talking a little bit about your book. Give people some insight about this book, Hope, and the whole idea of holding on to it as we go through this change.
Well, thank you. I mean, I wrote Hope, Healing Our People and Earth, because exactly that. I wanted to help people understand the bigger picture that's happening now. You know, when we look at the surface of an ocean, it can, you know, we look at the surface waves, it can seem incredibly turbulent, and it is. But when we actually can see the deep tides that is directing and guiding in an incredibly purposeful way, you know, the tidal shift, then I think it's much more empowering and inspiring and exciting. So that's really the message of Hope. And in it, you know, it's an acronym for Healing Our People and Earth as well, as you say. So as a cosmologist and healer, and really it shares my understanding of, first of all, the energetic connection between people and places, but also looks how different groups and countries, nations and collectively, we reflect the same issues, traumas, patterns that we do individually. Mm-hmm. And that when we can understand those at that national and group and collective level, then we can begin to see just as how we do on an individual level our own dysfunctional behaviors, we can begin to see how we can heal them and resolve them. And so Hope's about that. It's about understanding our hidden past. It's about understanding our heritage. It's understanding nation by nation these traumas. And it's understanding how to acknowledge them, to heal them, to release them. It talks about all the astrology, and the astrology is phenomenal at the moment. And that, for me, as well as you say, it's part of this bigger picture. We have such spiritual, in my view, such spiritual support for going through this shift. And I wanted to share that understanding and that message that is incredibly hopeful, what each of us can do about it. You know, to go, not just go with the flow of it, but understand that bigger picture and to show up, because Uranus into Aries, as we found when it went into Aries, and it, if you like, it ignited the Arab Spring. This is about personal empowerment. This is about what we can do, both individually and as we come together to heal ourselves and heal our relationship with Gaia, which I believe is crucial to this shift.
And it's interesting when you were talking about Uranus moving into Aries, because, you know, what we see going on in the Middle East with Israel and Palestine, and yesterday I noticed in the news Saudi Arabia, I think yesterday or the day before, allowing women to vote.
Yeah.
You know, and just what happened in Egypt and Libya, all those changes that are taking place, although on the surface they seem you know, especially in some of the war-torn countries, destructive, but it's amazing what's being birthed out of that.
Absolutely.
One question I have outside of the book, when you're talking about astrology, Cal and I have discussed this, and I'd be interested to get your perspective before we wrap this up. We're noticing that although the astrological influences certainly represent what's going on collectively with the shifts that are taking place mm-hmm. on many different levels, what we're seeing in people's charts, and I'm wondering if you've witnessed this or are experiencing this, some of those harder aspects that people are going through, if people are in alignment and they're kind of moving along their spiritual path, and they don't seem to be having the same influence that they have in the past. Have you noticed that at all?
Very much so. Very, very much so. My sense is that as we go with the flow of this, we are actually doing what my very first astrological teacher told me, which is the more that we can actually work on our own inner healing, the more we transcend the limitations of our astrological, makeup.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that what the shift is all about is it's shifting us from this personal perspective, the I of the ego.
Right.
And of course, our astrology, our personal astrology, is our personality
mm-hmm.
of that ego to the transpersonal.
Mm-hmm.
So the more we're in alignment with what's happening, the more we are liberated to an appropriate degree of, we're still our personality, but it's not limiting us to the extent it might have been even a few years ago if we're continuing to work on our own inner healing.
Absolutely. I feel that, and I'm witnessing that around me. So thank you for sharing that perspective. All right. Now I'd like you to tell people how they can get a hold of you, a hold of your books, any workshops or events you've got going on.
Thank you, Cirilla. Well, if people would like to come to my website, which is www.judecurivan.com, that's JudeCurivan.com. You can get my books easily from Amazon.com or Amazon.co.uk. And if you're based in any countries pretty much around the world, my books are in about 14 or 15 languages now as well, so you can read them in whatever language. I'm not doing so many workshops now, but I am speaking at large international events. So again, just go to the website and the events section of the website to have a sense of where I am and what I'll be doing. And you can sign up to my free quarterly newsletter by just going to the website. Oh, Cirilla, thank you so much. It's been wonderful, and I'll be delighted for us to continue to explore, because there is so much. And, you know, Hope also talks about why this is such a momentous moment as we move towards 2012 and beyond, and why it's so incredibly synchronous. So whenever you'd like to, I'll be delighted for us to share more.
Thank you. And for all you listening, thank you for joining us today. If you want to get in touch with me, as you know, my website is www.aspiro-lifestyle.ca. My contact information is there. And please, until next time, keep your energy flowing. Namaste. There we go, madam.
Thank you, my dear. That was such fun, Cirilla.
Oh, it was a pleasure. You are a delight. And thank you so much for sharing your story, because, as I said, I've read your other books. the 13th step and the eighth wave, right?
The eighth chakra.
Eighth chakra. Those are the two that I have also read, and there's so much information in those two because we didn't talk about other sacred sites, and there's a lot we could have touched on, but anyway, we just allowed it to go where it was meant to go, and I think the information you shared was really important for people to hear.
Thank you, my dear. I really, really appreciate that, and thank you so much. And, you know, at any time, if you'd like us to explore more, as I said, I'll be delighted to do that.
Excellent. And what I will do is once this is up at the 1st of October, I'll send you the link so that
Great.
If you want to post it on a newsletter or website.
I will do. I'll post it on the website.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you.
Delighted to do that. And thank you again for doing the Amazon review. If you've got the time, that would be wonderful.
I'll do that shortly. Okay. Thank you. And we'll be in touch.
Thank you, Sarah. Lots of love to you.
Same to you. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.